Hello and welcome to Hometown Alaska. Today we're talking about how to survive winter, and I would like to begin the program with this observation, and that is, if you can hear this broadcast, you are in fact an Alaska survivor, because we're halfway through winter now and you're still here, so that's good. Winter, not to put too fine a point on it, is a time of year when Mother Nature wants to test you and see what you're made of, if not actually to kill you. It's a season of slips and falls, frostbite and hypothermia, avalanches, and let's not forget, cabin fever. Ironically, one of the best ways of dealing with the rigors of winter is to find a way to get out in the midst of it and enjoy it. Unfortunately, it's when winter is most enjoyable, when you are snow machining, skiing, or skating, that you are at risk for some of the nastier possibilities of the great outdoors. With that in mind, let me introduce you to our guests. We have Dave Tugman from the Department of Public Safety. He was a statewide coordinator of search and rescue for the Department of Public Safety. Eric Cannon, a volunteer with the North Ski Patrol, and TJ Miller of the UAA Outdoor Leadership Program. And last but not least, Nathan Vandermost, Outdoor Program Coordinator at Alaska Pacific University. Welcome to everybody. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dave, I'd like to start with you. Is there a typical profile for a person that gets in trouble out there that you have to go out and rescue?
A typical profile?
Yeah, is there somebody that you're...
In the wintertime, generally, the most calls we get are after the hunting season, towards when it starts to get cold. People are really not prepared for the onset of cold because it can happen, like, overnight. Mm-hmm. We have several folks that, they don't... The weather's been warm, it's been nice, and next thing they know, they wake up with 3 feet of snow around their tent.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the calls we get, the majority in the wintertime, are actually snow machines, mm-hmm. overdue snow machiners, especially out west.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of variables out there with weather. And
but it's people being Alaskans. What you got there is people that are hunting and people that have to travel. It's
yes,
sort of the type of people are, that's sort of surprising to me. I think of the recreational person as the one that we often see being rescued, but it's...
Out west is a big problem because that's the only mm-hmm. means of transportation they have. A lot of times the planes can't even fly out there, so they're getting back and forth with snow machines, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of folks traveling out there.
Okay, and I forgot to mention that I think that there's a lot of people out there that have some good experiences with winter, and if you'd like to call in, the number is here in Anchorage, 550-8433, statewide. You're welcome to call us at 1-888-353-5752. That's toll-free. Or you can email us at hometownalaskapublic.org. Again, that is in Anchorage, 550-8433. Across the state, it's 1-888, that's 1-388-353-5752. Or by email at hometownalaskapublic.org. And Dave, I would assume that winter is a more difficult time for you to operate as well. It's more dangerous for you probably to help these people out.
Yes, it's dark, it's cold, the weather's not near as nice as usually is in mm-hmm. the summertime or the spring or even the fall, so the wintertime has its unique challenges, especially with our air assets.
And I think your assets are often volunteers, right? It's not, the state is not really set up to be a full-purpose rescue operation, I think.
Yes, that's true.
So who else would it be besides the state troopers or the public safety?
The state troopers in general, we actually don't have searchers that or mm-hmm. search groups that work for us, mm-hmm. Specifically for DPS. So we rely almost totally on the ground searchers to be volunteer groups from volunteer organizations around the state that are trained. They it's their hobby, it's their passion, and we have dog handlers, we have dog groups all over from PAWS and Wilderness Search and Rescue up in Fairbanks all the way down to Sea Dogs in Southeast mm-hmm. and ASARD here in the South Central. These groups are, if it wasn't for them, we couldn't do what we do.
That's interesting. So this person is sitting at home and get a call from you and rally out there and just go where the trouble is, I guess.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. Eric, I suppose that you've probably been called by Dave. You're a member of the North Ski Patrol here, and what would that entail? What would you have to do?
Right. We
we get our direction from the state troopers, mm-hmm. and basically troopers get a call about a search or rescue, and we mobilize, usually meet at the trailhead, and group up into strike teams or task forces, and those groups then have an assignment, go search this drainage, go to an avalanche site, set up a probe line to search, do a beacon search for a buried person.
What's a probe line? Oh, probe line.
Okay,
what is a probe line?
A probe line is a method for finding a buried object. What we do is we line up 8 or 10 people across and work our way upslope. And the idea is to probe with a metal or a aluminum probe and have 50 centimeter spacing. Mm-hmm. So this is going to give us a good probability detection for finding a buried object, person, snow machine, mm-hmm. a pack. And it's a very slow way to find something. So that's something we don't want to have to implement.
How much time does a person typically have if they're buried by an avalanche?
If the statistics are, in general, if you can find somebody within 15 minutes, mm-hmm. they have about a 90% chance of survival. 30 minutes, they're dropping to more like 50% survival, and then it just drops right off.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you don't want to get caught in an avalanche. That's the message.
And if you are caught, I guess your best chance of being dug out are by your buddies that you're with, if they're trained. It sounds like to me, because if you got to get there and you got to get out to the trailhead, and from the trailhead to the accident site, that doesn't leave much time for you be on body recovery, I would guess, at that point.
You got it, because you need oxygen for your brain. So if you're without oxygen for about 5 minutes, that's a serious trouble. So you're right, absolutely. Companion rescue, that's the number one way somebody's going to get uncovered and survive an avalanche.
How risky is it for the people that go on the rescues to follow up and be out there in the same country where an avalanche has happened?
That's absolutely rescuer safety for us, mm-hmm. is number one. And so we will decline a situation where we're put in too much danger.
Mm-hmm. And what would that entail? How would you determine that was too dangerous? Just a general judgment call about the snow conditions, et cetera?
Right. You do a hazard assessment. For example, if we got a call one late evening for an incident, is it important to go at that point, or do we want to wait till the next morning when maybe the storm's clearing and better conditions? So, we definitely check out the snowpack, snow stability, the conditions at the site, and make a decision on whether it's safe for, mm-hmm. we're basically volunteers. Should the volunteers mm-hmm. be put into that situation?
Okay. I'd like to remind everybody that this is Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Anchorage or Alaska winter survival, and you can call us at 550-8433 if you're in town, or statewide 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometownalaskapublic.org. So Nathan, you're with APU and you teach outdoor skills.
Yeah, I'm the outdoor program coordinator, and I put on trips and clinics for students to give them recreational opportunities to explore Alaska.
And what sort of skills you teach people to keep them out of trouble? What are the things that...
Well, a lot of the, we have various skill clinics, and then we also do trips. So, for example, I wanted to run a trip to Fairbanks to go to Chena Hot Springs and stay at a cabin. And this was, I believe, 2 weekends ago, and it got down to -50. And only had a few students signed up. We had several cancel because of the weather, obviously. So I ended up pulling the trip, but that's one example. We have some backcountry ski trips that we run. We do clinics on just basic avalanche skills, cooking clinics, like backcountry cooking, and just really basic introductory skills and clinics that give students the ability to go out on their own.
And you teach them about hypothermia and frostbite, et cetera?
Yeah, for example, on the Chena trip, that would definitely be a topic that we would mm-hmm. be covering, and making sure that beforehand, everyone has the appropriate clothing and equipment, and they know what they're getting themselves into to be comfortable when we're out there.
So do you have a class that is in backcountry safety per se, or is it just sort of wrapped into all your classes?
Well, in terms of, so I'm not part of the academic program, but the academic program, mm. Has a class called Winter Wilderness, which is actually leaving today. And they have, their class is broken up into several backcountry opportunities where they go out for one night at Hatcher's Pass, and then they do a 4-day trip at Turnagain, and then they do a 10-day trip, which is going to be on the Resurrection Trail. And so it's, they go out for one night, and you know, so students that have never camped before get an opportunity to figure out what it's all about, and then so then they can get prepped for the longer trip.
Okay, thank you. And Tim, you run a similar program, I guess, out at UAA, and do you have a different emphasis, or is that same territory that you cover?
Well, Nathan runs a recreation program, and mine's the academic side of things at UAA. And we offer academic courses, and they range from ice climbing, crevasse rescue, rock climbing, whitewater rafting, sea kayaking, all sorts of things. We recently started teaching an academic backcountry ski course, and it's been filled numerous times. And that's an ARRI, which is the American Institute of Avalanche Research and Education. It's a level one for those folks that take this course, which is kind of the minimum avalanche background and knowledge a recreational user should have, similar to the one your son took. So we have that, and then the main purpose of our degree program is to train leaders and administrators for outdoor recreation, and we have safety wrapped up in every single course that we teach.
So what are these two skills for surviving in a cold situation, you think?
The biggest thing is making sure you have the right equipment. Excuse me. And what Nate talks about is the first day you go out for like a day, and that's really their introduction to it all. And that's where they realize if their equipment's working or not working and what they need to change for a longer trip. And so it gives them those skills to become more proficient themselves. The main thing is proper equipment, which really includes wearing the proper clothing, dressing properly. Cotton kills is a big cliche out there, and cotton's really bad when it gets wet. So we start with teaching them how to wear the proper clothing, having proper equipment, making sure they have the proper safety equipment, but even down to things like making sure they're intaking enough calories, and hydration is a big exacerbator of hypothermia and frostbite. If you're not hydrated, that's bad news.
Okay, and Dave, you don't have to go far to get to the backcountry from here. I'd say it's, in fact, the backcountry sort of comes into town in some ways.
Absolutely.
And I know I've been lost in Kincaid Park before and thought I was going to die. And I've been, people killed up in just minutes off the groove trails here on the hillside. How often do you have to do a search in town or in the areas near the town?
We have quite a few searches. Mainly like Flat Top, a lot of places up there, the Glen Alps, the Eagle River system. We get a lot of calls out there. Those are just right out of town.
Yep.
Right in town here, we actually like the runner. We had a search for him for like 3 days, I think, going on here. He's right here by the campus.
That's it. And he got pretty bad. Frostbite, I think, is what happened with out there.
Severe frostbite on his extremities.
So that's one thing that you think about. It can happen right here in town without even having to go to the trouble of packing all your gear up and going out somewhere and get in trouble out there. You can get in trouble right here in town if you want. So what are the different levels of frostbite, or how does one recognize that you are becoming frostbitten?
The initial symptoms are sort of a burning of the skin. You get a kind of a wind blast, a bit of a chill, and then as your skin freezes, you can start to develop blisters. Those blisters can puff up. They can turn different colors, and the worst case would be if you actually lost a limb.
Mm-hmm. So that was Eric Cannon from the Nordic Ski Patrol. And Eric, have you ever frostbitten yourself?
Yep, certainly in Alaska.
Oh,
yeah, it's very common.
So how do you treat frostbite?
Avoidance. You gotta try to.
That's the one thing you do, I guess. It's your
really try to keep covered up if you can.
Your flesh freezes is what happens, and I guess that is damage at a cellular level is what goes on there.
Yep.
So there's not much you can do. That's why you lose the toes, I guess. I remember I was telling you guys earlier that we had this great film when I was a kid here, which was made by Dr. Bill Mills, about frostbite. And it was just surviving the film was something you felt proud of when you see these big blisters and stuff. And inevitably, some kid would see them and throw up. It was sort of one of our rituals of winter preparation here in Alaska. And I got to say, I've never been frostbitten thanks to that film, because it was so graphic and so scary that I decided that was not something I was going to mess with. And fortunately, I had not had to do that against my will, which is what happens to some people, I suppose, which brings up the mental thing. How do you protect yourself against your own desire to have fun in the wilderness? I know that people are often killed when there's snow machining or skiing, and it's you've gone to all this trouble to get out there, and it's hard to say to yourself, well, this could be avalanche. Danger is too high, and I should not go out today. How do you get to that point where you can tell yourself that? And or is this some, do you have a way of doing that?
Yeah, one thing that I always tell myself is that if I want, I'd like to continue to go out, and so I always try to be conservative, you know, especially with students in winter situations, because, you know, if an avalanche was to come down or if a student was to get in a bad situation, then that could be the end. And so that's one thing that is always in the back of my mind. But I think it's just being prepared. And if you, regardless of how cold it is, you know, if you have the right clothing, the right equipment, then you can be out there and you can be comfortable. And being able to recognize situations that may be declining, such as a winter or a bad storm that's coming in, or, you know, that temperatures will be dropping, or your equipment is failing on you. It's being able to recognize those things and being proactive about it.
So, Dave, do you see like a chain of bad decisions that often is what leads people to trouble? Or
a lot of times. And I think one of the things that you need to be aware of when you're out there is everybody makes plans. They have the, you know, this grand plan of what they're going to do for the weekend. They're going to go out. They're going to go snow machining. You know, it's a nice snow. So they get out there, and all of a sudden the weather starts to change, or some other circumstance comes up. And sometimes they don't assess all of those circumstances or the different aspects of what's going on around them. And those things can compound. And sometimes it's better to just step back and take another look at it and go, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't go on that trail today, or maybe we should go to a different spot today, or something like that. And I think when that happens and they don't do that, that's when people find themselves in trouble. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the indications are there. They just don't recognize them. So
those indications would be like the weather changing and the temperature varying wildly and things like that, or what sort of things would people look for that would cue them that this is not a good idea?
Changes in weather. If they had heavy snow, it's my understanding, I'm not an avalanche expert, mm-hmm. but if you had a heavy snow and the wind was blowing that day, that's usually not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Just things like that. And the best thing I can tell them is to go on the websites or attend some of these avalanche outdoor classes that we have here, where they're in abundance. They're everywhere, and there's really no excuse, mm-hmm. I don't think, for not educating yourself about this.
And so do you have a thought there, Eric?
Yeah, when you're planning a trip, there's a sort of a multi-stage thing. We've been talking about these avalanche courses. That's one component. Knowing your traveling companions and their skills and their attitudes, that's another thing. So when you're planning a trip a week ahead of time, you know where you want to go, who you're traveling with, and then within a couple of days of the trip, start gathering all this information from the websites, the weather, the avalanche information. And then actually when you're on the road and when you're at the site where you want to ski or ride, start looking around as you're driving in and as you're getting geared up. You know, do you see avalanches occurring? Do you see evidence? Because you want to be gathering all of the data at the site, and you want to analyze it with all the information you've been picking up the last week. And you're going to have to make a decision with all that, and you want to make the right decision.
Mm-hmm. So you've actually known people who have gone and seen avalanches occurring and have said, well, it looks like a good day for reading in the backcountry. That's amazing.
It can happen, yep.
I've been there.
That's interesting. I can't imagine that, but I guess that's because I've got a vivid imagination or don't have a vivid enough.
Well, and when it comes to decision making, as Dave pointed out, it typically is not one decision mm-hmm. that requires a rescue situation. It's typically a number of them, and they could all be very small and inconsequential, but the compounding factor of it all mm-hmm. is really what adds up. So, yeah, all of a sudden your fan belt on your snow machine breaks. Well, that's not a big deal. Hopefully you're a smart machiner and have a extra fan belt. And now you're putting it on, but it's 50 below and you exposed your hands to put it on. So it's a compounding factor of decisions that typically lead to these large-scale rescues.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you're wanting to call out there, but we do have the phones are free right now. If you'd like to call with a question or a comment or tell a story about something that has been sort of noteworthy that's happened to you in the backcountry or even here in town. I know that people have been killed by animals here in town, for example. And it's one of the things, you get stung by a moose, it's winter out there and there's all kinds of stuff that happens. So you can call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage or statewide 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we've been talking about bad decisions, and is there any way to compensate for bad decisions once you've made them, or did you just go to your cell phone and call for the troopers at that point? Is that
preparation?
So
that's how you combat your bad decisions, is having properly prepared your trip. As Eric had said, knowing your companions, knowing that they're skilled is a big part of it. Making sure that other people know you're out of town as well, that they have a trip plan mm-hmm. is another part of it.
So it's like flying, I guess. In some ways, you have to file a flight plan. It'd be the same thing, file a trip plan, let people know where you're going.
Even if you're going out for a few hours in town, because uh-huh. you may get trampled by a moose up in Flat Top. Yep. And if you didn't tell your wife or husband when you're coming home, then who knows when somebody will get called to come find you.
Yep. So. And on top of everything else, you feel really stupid.
Yeah.
At that point, because
yeah.
the totally preventable situation there. So.
And cell phones don't always work.
Mm-hmm. So what are the cardinal skills everybody should have before they go out then? Planning would be one of them, I guess. And what sort of things would set Alaska apart from other parts of the country when you want to go out there?
We're talking specifically in the winter.
Yes.
I can speak a little bit to the roadways.
Okay.
I mean, people don't think about that down south, you know. Mm-hmm. They get in their car and they drive to the next town. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 20 miles away. It's usually not a big deal. But up here, a 20-mile trip on the highways here in Alaska can be fatal.
Mm-hmm.
People don't think about the small things like, well, you know, I got a quarter tank of gas. I can make it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they find themselves in a snowbank and it's 50 below zero. They can't start the car because they're out of gas. And then it just starts to compound, and people find themselves in those situations a lot of times. And I think that's something that they don't think about up here in Alaska that's unique.
Yep. I do remember an awful story about a family that went up to the Denali Highway and was out there, and they ran out of gas. And I think that one of them was walking out to find help and died like around the corner from a roadhouse. It was in the whole loss. It was sort of thing where I just can't imagine it happening in New York or a place like that. You need the Alaskan way to go. So that's at least you get yourself, this is very Alaskan as you're lying there and getting hypothermic, which would remind me, what are the signs of hypothermia? Eric, from the ski patrol, would you?
The easiest way to think about hypothermia is the umbles.
The umbles?
The umbles. So are you mumbling? Are you stumbling? Mm-hmm. Are you fumbling? Basically, as your body's core temperature drops because of hypothermia, your cognitive skills decrease, your motor skills decrease. And so you might be able to sense this yourself, and you might have heard folks feeling warm and taking off clothes uh-huh. in the later stages of hypothermia. So you basically, your mind's not with you and you're declining, and that's a very serious problem. So,
and that's one of the things that you're sort of in a self-perpetuating situation. If you're not thinking clearly, and one of the symptoms of your problem is you're not thinking clearly enough to get yourself out of trouble, I guess.
Right, and here, I mean, so we have water hypothermia. We have down in southeast being inundated with rain. We have 50 below temperatures up at Chena. So many instances, you really have to be prepared and really watch yourself.
Mm-hmm. And what are the conditions that are most conducive to hypothermia, I suppose, when it's very cold out? So
you know, overexertion, mm-hmm. you know, wearing cotton, as TJ was mentioning, uh-huh. Falling out of a boat, not having your PFD on.
It's, I guess, one of the things that happens mostly to men is one of the things that I understand is falling out of the boat without a life jacket on. It's something that men do better than anybody, and that's one of the things you get to check yourself, see what your gender is, I guess, before you go out there. Because if you're the wrong gender, you're going to probably be in trouble more than if you're of the wiser gender.
The rule is always have a female with you.
Oh, that's, that reminds me of the time I was out actually mountain biking with my wife, and I said, this is a pretty steep place. Why don't you go down first? Because we'll go by behind you. That way, no, we'll get in trouble. But it was like too much for her. I had all these men behind her, and she went too fast. Disaster ensued, although nothing that we couldn't recover from. That's one of the things that's interesting. That go back to your knowing your party. Is there times when the parties have actually antagonistic people on them? It's, I see our two outdoor educators here nodding. What's that all about?
The big studies going on, not even big, but a lot of talk today in the avalanche education world is about the human factors, and mm-hmm. they can trace just about probably close to 100% of avalanches are caused by human factors and making poor decisions. And there are lots of factors we can have and lots of neat little nicknames for them and whatnot, but it's all simply making a poor decision, not being prepared for certain things, your group having, so think about a marginal condition day, you're going out and you've got a group of all males that are macho, gung-ho, worked really hard to get there. They're probably going to make a little bit more of a poor decision, and I'm a man, and I'm, mm-hmm. I will admit it, I'm okay
You've
with
got,
that.
You've got a beard, I can testify yep. that's what's going on here. This is man speaking.
But when you throw a woman in that, there tends to be a voice of reason, mm-hmm. and tends to stall the men in their decision-making and help them process information that a man may not have seen as well.
So what do you know about group dynamics, Nathan?
Yeah, if I could add to that, just back to your question in regards to how having one person that may not be as well equipped, how that can be detriment to the group. So, you know, when you're traveling in the backcountry, either whether it's the wintertime or regardless of what time of year it is, if you have someone who may not have like a positive attitude or just isn't well prepared, I mean, those things can bring down the rest of the group, and the rest of the group is trying to compensate for that person. So, for example, if you're going with a group of friends and you get to the trailhead and someone forgot their pair of gloves. And so then, fortunately, you remember to bring an extra pair of gloves, and so you lend that to them. But then you get back, you know, a couple miles, and the wind picks up, and you're stopping for a break, and the same person takes out your pair of gloves and sets them down, and then the wind takes them away. So now you're down a pair of gloves. And even though that may seem pretty insignificant, that can have pretty detrimental consequences.
Being the person that doesn't have any gloves anymore is now exposed to all kinds of
to the elements,
yeah, or that they're you're pissed at them because you now have no gloves.
Right, and that could also be an issue. Mm-hmm.
Then that adds to the fact because now you're angry.
Yeah. Well, I think that we'd like to discuss about this some more when we come back. The dynamics of your party is very interesting, but it's time for us to take a little break here. And for hometown, this is Peter Dunlap Scholl on KSKA Anchorage.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Okay, we're back here in Hometown Alaska, and if you have some wisdom about the outdoors that we're not uncovering here and you want to contribute, that's fine. Call us at 550. Oh, heck. It's 550. And I guess I'll have to get back to that number. It doesn't seem to be posted here right now, and we'll go back to what we were discussing a second ago, which was what's new about the person in your group that pulls out a flask. Dave, do you have some thoughts about that? You brought that up.
Well, yeah, it's common. I mean, a lot of times you could be out with a group and somebody, one of your friends invites one of their friends and you don't even know this person. And next thing you know, you're 20 miles out on a snow machine and he's sucking on his flask. And next thing you know, he's making really poor decisions. And now you're going to have to deal with this person who's really, it's like Nate talked about earlier, your group is only as strong as the weakest link. I mean, mm-hmm. And then it just brings everybody down.
So,
alcohol can be a problem mm-hmm. too. A lot of
yeah.
How do you deal with that? What do you say to a person that's drinking when you're out doing something like piling a high velocity machine around? What do you say to that person?
Well, if it was me, I would try to take the flask away from mm-hmm. him and say, "This is not a really good idea, and we're going to go back. Mm-hmm. We're going to go back right now."
So, we talk about group dynamics and. TJ, you mentioned that there's been a lot of studies now that are coming out about that. And we talked about the gender question, which was very interesting, I have to say. What are other factors of the group dynamics that are causing problems or are things that could be tweaked by people on the trail?
Summit fever, blue sky skin syndrome, smelling the barn. Those are all some mm-hmm. of the cliches. Summit fever is regardless of what you are observing around you, you have to get to the top. Blue sky syndrome is, it just dumped 25 inches of fresh powder. It's blue sky, let's go out and ski it. Not always the best decision. And then smelling the barn is making decisions that are trying to get you to your destination faster, which you then tend to make some poor decisions because you're moving fast to get home because you're smelling the barn, and that again can compound some of your decision making as well. So mm-hmm. those are some of the titles, I guess, or cliches that have come mm-hmm. out as human factors.
And there are, I suppose, group dynamics as well. Some person will smell the barn, another person will want to smell the roses, I guess, and just go very slowly. And does this complicate things as well?
Definitely. And talking about your travel group, really setting up your goal for the day with your group and you got to communicate with your group. You really have to talk to them and find out what their goal is for the day and if everyone's on board. And if you find out that maybe not everyone's on board or there's different ideas and goals, maybe it's time to split that group up. Or maybe Johnny busts out mm-hmm. the flask. Maybe it's time to not go mm-hmm. and say, you know what, let's do this another day, and then tell your buddy not to invite Johnny the next time.
That's interesting. One of the conventional things I heard when I was growing up was you don't split the group because then people get isolated and are in danger. But that is...
I wouldn't split it in the field. I would split it before we got there.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So at the trailhead, I would say, okay, I'm going to go home because I don't really like what's going on here. Or at the coffee shop in the morning when you're talking about your goals for the day or where you're going, decide then to split it. Never in the field. You're correct on that.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, this concept of human factors has been really popular in the last several years because in avalanche courses, you get trained up to be safe in the mountains. And what the statistics have shown is once you take a level one avalanche course, you're now a little more prone to maybe risk-taking. And so there's a common trajectory that you take a course, you gain some skills, and then you may have a terrifying experience, and that drops your confidence. And then you, with time building, your confidence increases mm-hmm. again. So human factors is the key. If you weren't in the mountains, avalanche probably wouldn't have gotten you.
Yeah, that's... Although a person could get hit by, I guess, snow coming off the roof. It was a problem with the pack they had here in town. Mm-hmm. It was designed without snow fences from the roof, and a person could legitimately be killed, I guess, by the snow cascading off the roof of a building.
Absolutely. Yep.
Jeff Nisman a few years ago out at Portage mm-hmm. from a roof avalanche.
The solution is move to Florida, I guess, get eaten by an alligator instead. So... Dave, you've been with public safety for a long time. Have you ever had a call and you had to say to the person, we just can't go out there right now. It's not possible for us to go and get you at this point because the conditions are way more than our capabilities?
That happens all the time.
Oh, yeah.
One that was really significant was a goat hunter last fall. They actually got stuck on the mountain for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't get in there. RCC couldn't get in there with their PAVOC helicopters. I mean, it was, the wind was so bad that it actually came down to a boat sitting down. It was anchored up, watching the weather for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that happens, a lot.
That reminds me of something I wanted to get to, but first I'd like to give out the numbers here. They are 550-8433 in town, if you have something you want to tell us about survival in Alaska winter, or you can call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Nathan and TJ, you guys both teach people how to survive in the outdoors. Do you teach them about this possibility they're not going to get rescued? There seems to be the ethical component here of you got to prepare well to be take care of yourself out there, because not only will you not always be able to be rescued, but it's sort of you're putting people at risk to rescue you. Do you have those discussions with your students?
Yeah, we definitely do. It is it is the nature of it, and letting them know to, one, be prepared is a big part of it, and extra clothes and extra food are a big piece to that. So teaching them, one, how to initiate a rescue is a big part of it, because we're training new guides, new leaders that are going to go out there. So one, how do they get a hold of Dave if they are in a situation, and understanding the fact that rescue may be multiple days away. And as Eric probably knows, there's a psychological aspect to rescue and people, and it's very interesting. We had a class a few years ago, that sea kayaking class, where the weather got pretty bad and we ended up pulling out of the water, and the students were incredibly concerned about not making it home that the next day or Monday, not making it to class, not making it to work, not surviving one night in town. There were multiple, or out in the field, there were multiple other options to get home. But it was very interesting, the psychology of folks that have never been in a situation to be rescued. But teaching our students who are going to be fellow leaders how to, one, initiate a rescue and make a rescue, help to make a rescue successful, but also understanding that mm-hmm. you're on your own. You should not rely on Dave and the crew to come get you. Mm-hmm. You really should take care of yourself more than anything.
There's a cartoon I saw once where a boat, a cruise liner, is actually like that Italian one. It's sort of vertical in the water, and there's a woman is up there with, talking to the captain. She says, "Sinking? Do I understand you correctly, Captain? Are you serious?" It's like she can't believe it. She's got a paddle for her life now, which is, I think, a hard thing for people to grasp sometimes. They are in a situation where it's got to be a strange moment when you realize that your situation is over your head and you have no ability to help yourself.
Well, and your definition of being able to help yourself and my definition are probably somewhat different. And there's all this new technology on the market today, the spot mm-hmm. locator. Now I think there's probably an app for the iPhone that's mm-hmm. rescue. Who knows? But I mean, you've heard in the last couple of years the use of these personal locator beacons for some incredibly avoidable and idiotic reasons. And mm-hmm. It's that, one, I'm not taking responsibility for myself, and I forgot to prepare, or I don't have a meal for the night, and so I need a rescue, or I'm cold, so I need a rescue. And Dave's got a hard job, because is Dave to be the judge of, well, you're not really in danger, sleep it out a night, you'll be fine, hike out tomorrow, mm-hmm. or do I send our resources in, which may put others at risk? And that's a really tough question. And but it's out there, and it's a reality, and I think we'll see it more and more as people take less and less responsibility and rely on technology to save them.
We'll have to depend on the reader's comments to shame these people into not doing that when they get written up in the paper.
Yeah.
Dave, what do you do when you get your phone call? How do you triage these people and decide when somebody is doesn't need to be rescued? How do you tell?
Well, very few do we not try to rescue.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it mainly depends on them. Like if we're telephone contact with them, and they say, well, you know, I got my sleeping bag. I'm going to set my tent up. I'm going to wait until tomorrow morning. I have food. I'm not cold yet. Everybody's fine, but I don't know if we're going to be able to get out of this. So in that circumstance, we may, if we have a good location, we know where they're at, and they're just going to hunker down, and we just can't get in there to get them that night. We may wait until the next morning. So if someone calls and they say, help me, we're going to go. We just can't triage that. I mean, if someone calls and they say, I need to be rescued, it's an emergency.
Okay.
So that's just the bottom line for us.
Mm-hmm. And that is given that the conditions aren't so bad that you just can't get there.
Right.
Okay. So do you think your students are more highly aware of this than the average Joe, or is this something you have to teach them, Nathan?
I think that... you know, students may come in with that mindset, but definitely making them more aware, as TJ was saying, that with the advent of technologies such as cell phones and GPS devices, that it's really important to be able to not rely on those things. And I also emphasize, like, being able to be really good with a map and compass because, you know, for example, if the batteries die on a GPS or if you accidentally drop it, then it's going to be useless, or you drop it in the water. So it's really good to be masterful at the very basic tools and being prepared and relying on no one else but yourself.
And how common is that anymore for a person to know how to use a compass? It seems like...
I don't think it's that common anymore.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think many people know, which is kind of sad.
Yep. It's interesting. We're sort of suspended by this technological guy wire, which is keeping people afloat in situations where they wouldn't normally go. I guess they have this feeling that they're going to get back because they have the GPS or something. And it's, I suppose, a new territory. Have you seen more people getting in trouble because they have the technological ability to get in trouble, Dave, or is that...
I think there's a trend towards that. I think they feel they have this feeling of safety because I have my cell phone. If I get in trouble, I can call. It's kind of a two-edged sword, and I'll kind of expound on the PLBs. I think the PLBs, the personal locator beacons. If someone sets off a personal locator beacon, the time it takes us to find them is significantly less. If they don't, we could spend days looking for this person. Thousands and thousands of dollars, putting hundreds of people's lives in danger, the rescuers out there beating the bush, the pilots in the planes, where if someone sets off a PLB, we have an exact coordinate, we can fly a helicopter directly to that location, pick them up, and bring them home. So, yes, it makes it easier for them to put themselves into dangerous situations, I guess you could say, but on the other hand, I think it keeps a lot of our volunteers and our rescue personnel out of danger because they're not out in the field as long. Mm-hmm. They're not these prolonged search periods. So I think in the long run, the PLBs are a really good idea.
Okay. And I didn't mean to knock. I think they're a great, great thing if they're used for the right reason.
Exactly.
Just because you're cold. Mm-hmm. Cold, not hypothermic. Cold, and you set it off. Or you're hungry, and you set it off. That's when they can be bad. But I definitely agree. It's really nice to... save hours and time and risk to fly right to a site and get someone out.
Yes, we've had people call in, but just because they were tired. I'm too tired. Yep. I can't make it.
My high heel broke off, and it's...
I'm too tired.
On a similar note with avalanche, we have these avalanche transceivers that you can wear. Mm-hmm. We have avalanche airbags now.
Oh,
we have
avalungs.
And we have all this technology that... just because you have it, you may still get tumbled around in that avalanche. You know, around a quarter of folks get killed due to trauma in avalanches. So you may have a beacon on, but you may not actually get out of that snowbank, slide.
What is an avalanche airbag?
Now, that's a new concept where you have, I think Dale Atkins in Colorado came up with the Brazil nut theory that if you have an airbag on your backpack that makes you buoyant, you can actually float to the top of the snowpack in the slide. And, you know, that may work. Mm-hmm. It's another piece. It's another tool. But just because you have that tool, you know, should you be taking that extra risk? That's a question for each individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to reintroduce my guests here for people who have joined us since the second half. And we have Nathan Vandermost, who teaches and leads outdoor activities at APU. We have Dave Tugman of the Department of Public Safety, the Troopers. We have Eric Cannon, who is our guest from the Ski Patrol. And we have TJ Miller, who is an instructor of outdoor recreation at UAA. And Dave, are there more people that are now interested in going out there? Or TGF, sorry. Do you have a higher level now than you had in the past? Or is it now that everybody has all these tools they can go out with?
Yeah, you know, it scares me. I moved up here in 2002, my first winter, and I'd been backcountry skiing. And you can obviously tell that's my winter addiction and avalanches. But I remember Turnagain Pass 10 years ago. I'd see two cars in a parking lot. Now, I remember we were down there. I counted 85 cars between Summit Lake and Tin Can, which is the main corridor of the backcountry ski mecca. That is awesome and not so awesome in the same. I wonder how many are highly trained out there and what they're doing. I know some certainly rely on safety and numbers. It blows my mind when I see a lone guy hiking up thinking that they're safe because there's 45 other people on that mountain. It has increased. Technology has aided in the increase in use. Of course, disposable income has aided in that. And I think backcountry skiing has increased substantially due to the prices of Alyeska. Mm-hmm. Season passes is a big one. But the avalanche transceiver is the tool. And, you know, people pack on $2,000 worth of safety equipment with a beacon, a shovel, a probe, a $10,000 snow machine, and they go out there and end up getting hurt anyways. And it's a sad day when someone doesn't have the right knowledge and preparation to go out and recreate, and it puts others out there in risk. It puts Dave's crew at risk. It puts Nordic Ski Patrol at risk. I mean, it puts lots of other people at risk when someone gets hurt out there.
So, Dave, have you seen more people calling for help over the last, say, 10 years? Or is it flat?
I believe so. Our numbers have increased slightly over the last few years. We haven't kept real precise records since we started in about 2005, mm-hmm. Keeping the SARS statistical records like we do now. Uh-huh. And they've increased a little over the years, but generally we'll have about 700 to 900 calls a year.
Wow.
Out of those, 300 to 400, maybe a little over 400 calls actually are search and rescues, where we have to send assets into the field. So those remain fairly steady. They have for the last few years.
So you see 300 to 400 people that you got to rescue every year?
No, there's probably out of that, you're talking up to 700.
Oh, because parties, multiple
victims. Yep. Sometimes there's four or five in a party year.
Wow.
That's amazing. So, I just didn't know it was that many.
That's yeah. So I think we had about 750-ish somewhere, mm-hmm. maybe a little more than that last year, actual cars. But a lot of those are overdue snow machines, overdue hikers, overdue hunters, where they self-rescue, or, you know, the wife calls in, yeah, my husband's not back. And then the trooper goes and checks at the parking lot, and the guy's coming down off the mountain. And so we get a lot of those calls where we actually answer the calls for service, but mm-hmm. we don't have to send assets out into the field.
How does the Alaska sort of the organizations that are here, how do they compare with out of state, with say Colorado or places like that? What sort of organizational ability do we have as a state compared to other places to help people out?
Best rescue group in the world, I think.
Yeah, in Colorado, you know, you have 4 million people. You have a lot more resources. But here in Alaska, we have 700,000 folks, and the communities really need to cooperate. And mm-hmm. it's amazing. There's a group, Alaska Search and Rescue Association, ASARA, and it's been a real pleasure to be part of that. There's 40 plus volunteer groups a part of ASARA, and we're all here on the same goals to help out our fellow folks in the community. And we all cooperate for this common goal. It's a real pleasure to be part of it.
And how big is the volunteer component in is it typical, I guess, array of sources that you have outside? Would that be as heavily volunteer dependent as it is here? or it just seems to me that we've got a unique spot here. We're surrounded by wilderness. We talked about this a little bit before. You come into Anchorage and there's nothing but wilderness for thousands of miles in any direction. And it seems like I always figured Alaska would be sort of the cutting edge when it comes to this sort of thing. But I'm trying to get the sense of that. Is that what we've done here, or is it
The distance here is a big factor. So distance, accessibility, resources, we're more limited here in Alaska.
So it's the stakes are higher every time you go out the door here than they are in Colorado or California or places like that.
Yes.
You know, I can say from a management standpoint, in my position, I had the ability to go to a National Search and Rescue Conference down in Sparks, Nevada last year. And the first part of that is the Statewide Search and Rescue Coordinators Council meeting. And as the Statewide Search and Rescue Coordinator, I'm a member of that, an automatic member. So what I learned there, I had the guy sitting right next to me was from Texas. And our circumstance up here is very, very unique because this poor guy has to deal with 72 or 75 counties, and each one of those counties has a different sheriff, and they all have their little piece of the pie, and they do their things their way. So the guy was just beside himself when he found out that here in Alaska, we have one statewide search and rescue coordinator. Everything goes through the state troopers. We're the ones that are responsible, and it's outstanding the way it works. I mean, I think we probably have the best system from what I saw.
Okay, so I'm going from don't get in trouble to, okay, I'm going to go out and not pack enough and wear cotton and stuff. No, don't do that.
I'm talking about the management side as far as how things work, our relationships with the search groups. We're all on the same sheet of music.
Mm-hmm. So what is that guy worried about in Texas? Is that probably people getting killed in the avalanches there?
No, but the basic search and rescues.
Same thing?
Same. I mean, they have assets, but every sheriff, you know, is going to have his search and rescue group, and they're going to do their things their way. They're not going to talk to the county next to them. And, you know, it's not like somebody lost knows when they cross the county line. So those are a lot of the issues. And we don't have counties up here, you know. It's unique up here.
We do have a lot of tourists. I wonder if they add to the problem, because I would suppose Alaskan, when they've lived here for a certain amount of time, has a certain amount of savvy about keeping themselves together in the backcountry. But I think that if you're from New York and you're just out here, you're assuming that it's like New York. And I wonder if they get in more trouble than Alaskans do.
I think so. I think that there's... And I'll take Flat Top because I think it's a pretty good example. I could see, you know, don't we have a Flat Top taxi now that will take you up there? And I can just picture 15 New Yorkers or New Mexicos or Alabamans or whatever you want to call them. But I could see a van load of them going up there, and that's scary to me because they don't understand that a storm could move in, you know, a matter of an hour, and they're not paying attention. They don't know what happens up here. And I definitely think that they understand the mystique, and they have an idea of the concept of the risk, but they don't understand the reality of it all. So they think, oh, it's Alaska, it's a little bit scarier, there are bears, there are moose, there are this, there are that. But then they don't do anything to sort of counteract those hazards and those risks. And not to say everyone.
Mm. Well, I do remember a story in a travel magazine of some kind that said Anchorage is a great city. It's one place where you can have a really fabulous meal and then maybe go to a show and then go out and an hour later be in jeopardy of your life because you're in the wild country all of a sudden and you're not ready for this. It's a great thing about where we live, I guess. So I guess we're going to be out of time here. I wonder if you guys have any great stories that you have of particularly sterling events, rescues that really stick out, or moments where you really realize that you made a mistake. I don't know if you care to admit to those, but if you have any really great stories, I think that's one of the things that is a way of teaching is to take apart a story and see what went wrong. So you might want to volunteer for that.
Well, we're going to have an interagency search and rescue training this weekend up at Hatcher Pass, and one of the case studies that we're looking at for that was a 2008 set of avalanches in Turnagain Pass, where one weekend a group of snow machiners got in trouble and two machiners died. The next weekend, because of in the intervening week, the storms were too bad to go recover those folks. And so the next weekend, groups went out to search and recover the bodies. At the same time that was happening, another avalanche occurred in Sunburst across the valley. And that's an amazing story of the resources being there and the searchers having the right training and the right equipment. And the person was unburied, alive.
That's great.
And that's very rare for a group search and rescue to actually
search and rescue somebody. That's
it's mostly.
And that was a gigantic avalanche on Sunburst.
So that's a story where things were going right, training was correct, timing was very fortuitous.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's interesting because that's just fortuitous is what is the key word there. I think you were in trouble when there was help nearby, and you can kind of test that with the guy that was went for a ride in Nome, I think, and all I had was beer, and you survived on frozen beer for 3 days, but his truck ended up in the snowdrift. And I think if you look at what we talked about during the hour, you can see a number of mistakes here. The guy did not tell anybody where he was, I think, and he didn't have supplies. He wasn't thinking about what can go wrong in Alaska, which is a lot can go wrong pretty quickly if you're not on top of things.
I wonder how many people driving around in Anchorage right now have a blanket, a shovel, water, snacks in their car. Mm-hmm. I wonder about that because you may only be going to Eagle River, but if it's snowing out there and you get stuck in a bank, you know, it sounds so simple, but it as soon as you get handed a situation to you that you're not prepared, it turns scary.
Yeah.
And simple things, blankets, water, food, shovel, in your car can be the savior.
I think if you go to our website, you'll find that we have some links up that are to things like what pilots would have to carry, and it's going to be kind of a good rule of thumb, I think, to just assume that you're going to be in as much trouble as a pilot might be someday, and they have to carry, among other things, I think. I don't know if it's still true, Dave. Maybe you can tell. They used to have to carry a pistol, and that was a problem for some people because they'd be flying to Canada, and they'd have to bring their arms into Canada, which was not kosher with Canada law. So what sort of things do you have to have in your plan, you know?
I know they have to have a signaling device.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the gun. I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay, well, I guess we can refer people to the website for that. And
yeah.
I want to thank all of you for coming in. It's been really fun for me to talk to you about this. It's been T.J. Miller from UAA and our friend Eric Cannon from the North Sea Patrol and Dave from State Troopers and Nathan Vandermost from APU. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been very interesting and educational for me.
Thank you.
And this has been Hometown Alaska. And next week, I believe we're going to have Kathleen McCoy on, who will be teaching us about, or telling us about Objects Runway, which is the fashion show that is the Alaskan fashion show, which should be a very interesting program, I think. Hometown Alaska is produced by Kristen Spack. And Pat Yak is our vice president in charge of news for the station. And this is Peter Scholl for Hometown Alaska saying thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.